Hi chums, welcome to episode 5 of the Never Iron Anything podcast. This has been created to keep you occupied during the virus lockdown and as part of the Never Iron Anything Honest Review Month, which is now 2 weeks into its run. My name is Tony Esmond, creator of the Hoare Chronicles and Cockney Kung Fu, and I'm joined by a man I describe as the Terry Thomas of the comics industry. He's smooth, he's saucy, and he likes a game of horsey-horsey. It's Mr. Cliff Cumber. Hello, Cliff.
I say, Mr. Edmund. Oh, what? Oh, that's a bit of a tickler.
I think Vince would be proud of that intro. I wrote it with him in mind. He'd like that, wouldn't he? He's quite good with the old intros.
He's very professional.
Thank you.
He is very good with the intros.
He is.
And it would be even easier for him if you weren't always messing it up for him.
Yeah, and his last message to me on the WhatsApp just said, "Oh, Jesus."
Oh, Jesus.
So I think good. Somebody shocked him about something. I don't know what that's about.
Who could that be?
Oh, I don't know. So today, we're doing another one. These are coming fast and furious. The aim of this podcast is to give an overview of a comic or a series in the hope that people will both find our conversation interesting or at least not too annoying and head off and buy said comic, series, or whatever it is. And in doing so, keep themselves occupied during these trying times. That's the aim of this podcast. This week, I put it out to Mr. Cumber and to challenge me with a book or something to read. He came back with, I'm going to describe it as a small boutique of comics.
It is. It's a bijou, sort of very bijou, artisanal, hand-curated, hipster boutique of comics.
That's a very good description. Yeah. I think we're done now. I think we can go.
All right, that's it. This was great, Tony. Thank you.
Thanks, mate.
All right.
So, do you fancy a pint? Why not join us down the Black Crown? That's good, isn't it? That's not bad, is it? Come on.
I was swigging out of a can at the exact moment that you decided to throw that out there. Yes.
Yes,
have
folks.
A pint down
week,
the Black Crown Pub.
Black Crown Pub, which is actually a real pub in comics.
Is it?
Well, in the comics, it is.
Well, in comics, yeah.
And so we're talking about Black Crown, which is, and it was, sadly was, an imprint of IDW.
Yes.
I'm going to give you a little potted history. So, created by Shelley Bond and her husband, Philip Bond, it was announced in 2017 in April, and I believe it was launched in October 2017.
That's when most of the books seem to have come out, like the initial run, I think.
Yeah. I think so. I was at a launch thing, a sort of launch panel at NYCC, which Shelley and Pete Milligan were on. It was kind of a weird one, actually, because it wasn't hugely attended, but it was kind of split into two. So one half of it was the Black Crown sort of launch announcements, and they talked about Kid Lobotomy, which I'm sure we'll get onto in a minute. And the second half of it was about the IDW Full Bleed project, which was on Kickstarter at the time, which is a kind of whole other story, really. They announced the cancellation of the imprint last year, so in September of 2019. As it stood at that time, they still had a few books to put out. Eve Stranger, which was, I believe, their final book to hit print, ended 2 weeks ago, New Comic Book Day. And that was the last one, much delayed. So I think the first issue was in May. It was a 5 or 6 issue miniseries.
They published like one and then the imprint went under. Or at least they shut the imprint, I think, right?
No, I think
one
it was,
or two?
I think it was maybe two or three, yeah. And then
oh, okay.
The, yeah. Yeah, it would have been that. I know, because I reviewed the first one in May.
All right. Yeah, that makes sense.
And then I think the second one had come out by August, because I bumped into Dave Barnett at MacPow, and I was chatting to him about it. So I think it was 2, maybe 3.
All right.
Yeah.
I've done my research, as you can tell.
There was a brief that came out. If you go to the Black Crown website, there's quite a sort of wordy mission statement. But one of the paragraphs is the brief. So it's the brief about Black Crown, and I believe this was written in April 2017. And it said to create, and this is quite wordy, actually, and a little bit, excuse me.
The manifesto?
I've only taken a paragraph out of it, but excuse me if I get a bit bored in the middle of it. So it's to create an unprecedented environment wherein characters, brackets, the story kind and the creative types who enable them, commingle, corrupt, and, this is important, correlate to individual comic book series under the Black Crown imprint. Now, that's the fourth time I've read it, and I still don't really understand it.
No, I was it's a little manifesto-y, okay? So it's a bit sort of like, you know, in the bedroom, not having had a lot of... Actually, like something I would turn out maybe in the next couple of days, because really I haven't had a lot of social input in the bedroom.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Among the other things I turn out in the bedroom.
Lots of things, but, isn't it? It's quite a busy, but, you know, quite a busy area.
It is. It's highly trafficked, you could say. But yeah, it's like there's a lot of C's there, and it's trying to be super, super kind of clever, right? I think, you know, and but yet it's not actually making a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think so. It's a strange one, isn't it?
Which I think is a good description overall of sort of all of it. I mean, not to get too negative too quickly on Black Crown, but
yeah.
I think overall, not a lot of it made a lot of sense.
Okay. So shall we go into the tiles and we can examine it?
Yeah.
So, no, let's not do that. First, my first question is where did you first discover it? So were you on board from the beginning or?
So, how I discovered it was the Awesome Comics podcast, right?
Okay.
You guys, you remember you reviewed it a little bit early on, I think.
I think we talked about Punk's Not Dead, I think was the main one, because obviously we know Martin.
That's right. Yeah. Did you have him on the show?
Yeah, he's been on the show with David. I think they came on. Come in with
him and
before,
David Barnett.
Yeah, I think it might have been before we had Shelley on.
Right, and you know what? And that was the one. That was the one where I was like, oh, you know, that sounds really interesting as a title.
Yeah.
And it really did. I mean, it actually of all the Black Crown imprints, that was definitely my favorite. Then you interviewed Shelley, and I was like, oh, okay. So Shelley is the editor, and she was really interesting, I thought, about some of the stuff that led to the creation of Black Crown. So I was like, oh, yeah, here's an imprint. Definitely going to give that a try, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's worth explaining here that what it is, that the basic premise of it is it's a series of books that are only linked by being in a kind of shared universe, which I'm going to talk about later because I think kind of fell over a bit at some point.
Yeah, yeah. So it's all and I think if you read all of this, if you read all of the stuff, like for example, on the website, it's all tied into the Black Crown pub.
Yeah,
which you said was a real pub in comics, but might not necessarily be an actual real pub.
If it was, I'd go to it because it seems a sort of dirty place I'd go to.
Yeah, it is a filthy place and kind of weird.
And what it had a central hub. If you thought of it as a wheel, the central hub is Black Crown Quarterly.
That's right.
Which is a sort of anthology stroke zine stroke magazine kind of arrangement. There was interviews in it, and there was strips that started in there and then span out, and there were also sort of standalone strips in there. Did you read any of Black Crown Quarterly at all? Or
I did. I read all of them. I read all four.
Okay.
Sort of to a degree after, I think after it. I reread them recently, but I read a couple of them as they were coming out.
Right.
It was, I think that was kind of their, I don't know, like their tester, their taster, experiment with stories and some other concepts. But I think also to sort of see whether or not any of those stories kind of had legs.
Yeah, I think so. I enjoyed some of it. I'm not going to say I enjoyed it all. I found some of it a bit of a slog. I don't know why Shelley is so obsessed with the band Cud. Every interview I ever seem to see of her over the last sort of 3 or 4 years, she mentions this band. And they had a comic strip as if they were in an old people's home or something, as I recall. I can't quite remember.
That's right. So it was Philip, her husband Philip, who illustrated it. And for those who don't know Philip, he's just sort of a long-time stalwart of the British comic scene from the very beginning, since the 80s, you know, that whole revolution in the 80s. And it was somebody she knew was a member, I don't know if there was one of the creators was also a member of the band, whether it was Philip or someone else.
I
can't remember.
I think you're right, man. Yeah, I think he was a co-writer or a writer, I think.
Yes, yeah. I think you're right.
For those who don't know, Philip Bondi was a big part of the creation of Deadline. Probably my favourite work of his was Kill Your Boyfriend, which came out sort of 95, around that time, from Vertigo. He did a Vimanorama, I got that out, Time Flies for 2000 AD, and also Tank Girl, which he's very famous for, I think.
That's right.
And he's a sort of fairly softly spoken, but like very talented cartoonist, in my opinion. He's got a really sort of distinct style.
Absolutely. Well, Philip Bond is, I mean, you see that sort of, I think that definitely he and Jamie Hewlett were a big influence on each other.
Yeah.
And you can see in his style, that formative style, kind of some of Jamie Hewlett's style too. And I mean, for me, I always loved Philip Bond. I mean, he was heavily influential on sort of how I do inks and things like that.
Okay.
And, you know, yeah, I love Philip Bond's
strong,
work.
Strong brushy feel to his inks sometimes, I feel. There's like a real dark depth to the outlines on a lot of his characters, which I think, but very sort of clearly defined. There's no sort of scratchiness a lot of the time. He's got, I suppose we'd call it a sort of kind of manga style now if we looked at it.
Yeah, almost. He was very prototypically sort of that, but also very, very, I mean, he fitted well in 2000 AD. He had that kind of, he had a very cartoony there was a spectrum, so it went from being super cartoony to sort of to a degree really realistic, you know, and definitely his inks were really on point, I think, but I've always loved that kind of style, definitely.
Yeah, and Shelley's as influential, if not more than him, in the comics world. She was she started, as I understand it, as a comics intern at Cameco, was a favorite company of mine. Next Man and Mage, and I think Elementals came out of there. It was a real bizarre place, you know, some real, and as I understand it, there's some kind of rights issue where some of it we won't see. There's some of the comics that came out of there, like I'd die for an Elementals, you know, Omniboo, but
my god, yeah, I've got some of the original Elementals downstairs,
the Bill Willingham stuff. Yeah,
Bill
really
Willingham
good. Yeah.
Bill Willingham. You know, I mean, it was, I remember Bill Willingham's illustrations from the initial, you know, the original D&D books.
Oh, of course, yeah.
That's how long ago, yeah. And again, another guy, another artist whose style I really, really loved. And of course, when he, you know, the Elementals came out, I was like, oh my God, he's making comics.
Yeah, it was like a sort of saucy Fantastic Four almost, wasn't it? It was
a
lot of teenage
sure.
angst. Yeah, no, it was a great series. And then she moved to Vertigo, famously, where she was for many years. She worked under Karen Berger. Berger, and then when Karen left, I think she took over the role as heading it up over there. And I think the last time I saw her when she was in place, that was a few thought bubbles ago. I remember walking into a hotel and saying goodbye to Mr. Wild Goose as he went and had a coffee with her, and I was thinking, oh, big things are happening for Mr. Wild Goose. And then I think the next time I bumped into her was. Funny enough, we were talking about Pat Mills earlier, Pat Mills book signing, and she turned up. She was in the UK, and we started talking about what was happening with Black Crown, and I think it was just sort of I think it had been announced, and they were waiting for some books to come out, and she was very effusive about Martin Simmons' work. I've told him a number of times, I won't make him blush again, but she spoke sort of super highly of his work, and I'll make her right around that. And she's very great. I have to say, I think she's a great salesperson. It's a shame we don't have her in comics anymore. You know, not anymore, right at this moment in time. But what she said to me on the shop floor in Orbital is what I heard her say on the Word Balloon podcast, which is what she said on our podcast. So she had a sort of spiel. You know, and believe me, having sold books for Nobrow, I've got a spiel, and I can tell you it's difficult to think of something every time. But yeah, she's certainly a good saleswoman, you know, and the enthusiasm was really there for it. You know, we all were hoping for big things, you know.
Yeah, she's undeniably an incredibly passionate editor, I think. And she undeniably had a really solid vision for where Black Crown was going or what she wanted Black Crown to be.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as much as that was an asset, to my mind, I think it was also part of Black Crown's downfall. But, you know, we can get into that a little later on.
Yeah, I think so. And we'll talk a bit about the music and maybe the nostalgic value of it in a minute. But should we go through some of the titles they had out?
Well, yeah.
I'll get your opinion, what you think of each of them. I haven't necessarily read them all. I've read a good chat of them. So Assassinistas, which was Teeny Howard and Gilbert Hernandez. Obviously, anyone is a fan of the Hernandez brothers. Gilbert has got that sort of slightly flatter, slightly crazier style than a couple of them. I really appreciate his work. What did you think of that one?
I hated it. I really did. Okay, so just one caveat here, and this might get me into trouble, but I'm not a huge Hernandez fan. I don't really know anything about him.
Right.
I never followed their work on just about anything, I don't think. Right. So this is, Assassinistas really is my first introduction to Gilbert Hernandez's art.
Oh, really? Okay. That's an interesting way to come into it.
And I was really, I understand he has a certain cult value, that there's a degree of people who really love what he does. But to me, this was sort of, I didn't think the art was strong enough for a title like this.
Okay.
Well, this particular story, all the figures just were far too static. The backgrounds were kind of bland.
Yeah.
You know, I felt the lines didn't vary at all. It just felt to me like he kind of phoned it in. But I mean, if you know his work better, then maybe I'm way off base.
There's a lot
here
to be said about getting your eye in with an artist sometimes. There's a lot of artists mm-hmm. I never appreciate initially who later I've gone on to love, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. No, undeniable. I mean, I'm thinking from the perspective of somebody, I do a little bit of art myself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can't claim to be anywhere near his standard or fame, but it just seemed like the art itself was
a little bit
too naive.
I found it very flat. And I mean, the beauty of Love and Rockets is in the personalities. You know, Love and Rockets itself isn't like super. There's no, you know, there might be the odd car chase, but there's no rocket ships smashing into planets every issue.
Right.
You know, it's not really, and it's about the beauty of the different worlds that these people inhabit in
exactly. Yeah,
and I don't think the writing was there for me. I think I read the first one digitally, and I just found the whole retired female assassin thing a little bit okay. Yeah, didn't grab me. Put it that way, I suppose.
No, it was pretty bland, and I mean it was supposed to be an action-packed story. There was a lot of action in it.
Yeah.
And I found just the characters and storylines just to be a little trite and unimaginative. And the whole concept was a bit sort of there for me.
Okay.
Yeah. Especially combined with that style of art, I think, you know, whereas that would work with Love and Rockets and maybe a more kind of personalized tale like that, you know, less sort of fantastic.
Yeah. It's, is he a bit too indie? I prefer his black and white sometimes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
There's a bit of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I'm looking at his work now, and I can see, like, there are other, I think maybe I did this at the time. I can't remember because it was sort of so ultimately forgettable for me. But I think other art that he's done has been better.
Yeah.
And maybe more, you know, more attuned to the kind of stories that he's being handed. Because I'm looking at some pages of Love and Rockets, and it's beautiful. The line weight varies.
Yeah.
You know, there's just more detail in it. There's more thoughtfulness to his construction of his pages. And, you know, it just seemed like Assassinista was just something he tried to get through as quickly as possible.
Yeah. We'll definitely talk about Rushed in a minute. But, yeah, I get that sense as well. Yeah. I think maybe it's a strange thing to say as well, but I think his work plays out better on a bigger page with more...
Maybe.
Love and Rockets is almost sort of UK magazine size. I don't know.
And I'm looking at it now. I see what you mean about his black and white work. Well, it's clear that he made a decision between his black and white and his colored work. So there's a lot more spotted blacks in his black and white work than there is. Yeah.
Do you think he let the coloring speak a little bit more than he should have done, maybe?
I think maybe he did. Yeah. I think, you know, I think maybe he leaned on it a little too heavily, but I also think like maybe he was just like, oh, well, you know, I'll let the colorist do the work, which is kind of what a lot of artists these days seem to be doing, is leaving a lot of palette room for colorists because they're more painterly. But this one was completely flat with its colors. It was like an old fashioned four color, you know?
It was almost like a newspaper strip in a way to me. Yeah. The designs are a little bit weak sauce for me. I forget the name of the member of the three that comes back and kidnaps the kid. I can't think the name.
It's honestly, I need to go back and reread it because I did read it the first time. I didn't go back and reread it, but it just, It just didn't stick. I couldn't find the appeal in it.
I'd recommend Love and Rockets. I think you might not like it, dude. It's a whole different ball game. It's a whole different thing from this. Should we move on? Should we move on to the next one?
So yeah,
the
yeah,
next one I've got here is also written by Teenie Howard, and it's called Euthanauts. Now, I have to admit to having read the first one. I think I might have given up before the end. It's art by Nick Robles. I have to say, I absolutely adored the art. I just found it like a morass to get through. I felt like I was wading through treacle trying to just absorb the art and also keep up with the story, which I found very slow.
Let's talk about the positive stuff. Okay. The art was impeccable.
Yeah.
I love the art on this. Oh my God. Just it's, you know, the scope and the cinematography of it, of the art, the coloring, everything about it, and the imagination of churning out that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
absolutely beautiful. The covers were gorgeous.
But
the story, let me read you my note here. Navel gazing, wanky contemplation of death.
Is a funeral parlor receptionist goes to work for explorers. And do they explore death? Is that all the other side I put in my notes? Something like that.
Yes.
To be fair, it all went blank and I was thinking about puppies and Mother Teresa by the end of it. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of, it didn't grip me, put it that way.
No, and I think part of the problem was it was trying a little bit too hard to be Wicked and the Divine, which I find problematic. But I see sort of that the creation of its own unique universe and its own laws of physics, and then create a story within that universe and those laws of physics or whatever.
Yeah.
It just got so kind of incomprehensible. It was so incomprehensible right from the get-go.
Yeah, wasn't it? Yeah, you know, I mean, after we talked about, you heard me and Sarah talk about Electro Assassin. That's a long read.
That's a
dense read. And I've got the patience for a long read given the right circumstances, you know, a dense thing. But I just found it a slog. Maybe one day I'll go back and I'll read a hardcover of it and I'll rediscover it and a nice oversized hardcover with full of that gorgeous art. Might be okay. Yeah. You know.
Absolutely, and I think the art is definitely worth sort of just taking some time and looking at. I think, you know, from the perspective of an artist, it's so beautifully conceived and so well rendered. I think, you know, who was the artist on it again?
Nick
it was Robles.
Yeah,
Robles, right? Yeah, he's definitely got a career ahead of him if he chooses.
Yeah.
I think I reached
out to him at the time and expressed it. And he replied and, you know, seemed like a nice guy and everything. Yeah, I really do like that.
Real talent.
Yeah, definitely. I could see him drawing like a sort of noir-y or an espionage thriller or something like that, you know, something with a...
Or I'd love to see him do like a true horror.
Okay.
I think he could really pull that off with his kind of style, a sort of Lovecraftian horror. I think that would be fantastic.
Okay. Yeah, give him a bit of era-specific stuff maybe, yeah. Next one I've got is Eve Stranger, which I know we mentioned a minute ago, which was kind of the last book to finish. So I've got a slight horse in the race in that I know David Barnett a little bit from being on the pod and meeting him at podcasts and meeting him at conventions and stuff. But he's a nice guy. He's a novelist, I think, is his main sort of employment, and a journalist. And he wrote, this was his second book for them after Punk's Not Dead. I have to say I enjoyed the main story of this. I think there was a backup in it, which I just really just didn't take to. It was... too jarring a change, but obviously with Philip Bond's art and David writing, it was so it's kind of a female spy series crossed with a sort of jumping about between bodies thing going on.
So the idea was that she had a drug in her system that caused amnesia after each job, right?
Yep.
And then had to go back to so she'll wake up in all sorts of different situations.
Yes.
Having another job. So it was like Memento just over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw a review refer to it as Quantum Leap, but Memento is a much better example because in Quantum Leap he always remembers dressing up as a lady last week, doesn't he?
He enjoyed it too.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fun romp. I probably would like it in a hardcover book or something like that. I think both of them wrote well. You could see they were having fun with it. It's just a shame it was quite delayed.
yeah, Yeah.
That was a problem with it.
And I think it's a real shame that it came at the end, because there were two titles that I think really stood out for me with Black Crown.
Okay.
And so Punk's Not Dead was definitely one of them. And the other one was Eve Stranger. And I thought Eve Stranger had definite potential.
Okay.
You know, I really thought it had a good... you got to have stories with a bit of mystery, and then and gradually I think reveal that mystery over the course of whatever arc you're doing, and I think that had that potential.
It was like a modern Prisoner to me. It had that to it almost, you know.
And of course, you know, Philip Bond can do no wrong in my book.
Yeah, so, mate.
You know, absolutely. And it was a good. I think it was a lot more. There was a lot more levity to that than there was to some of the other titles, which really sort of disappeared up their own sphincters. You know, with sort of.
I know which one you're talking about, and we'll get to it in a
self-indulgent.
Second,
sure, yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Okay, so what have we got out of that? So we've got, if we count Black Crown, we've got Assassinistas. We're saying no. Black Crown. Mm-hmm. We're saying yes. Euthanauts were saying 50-50, and Eve Stranger was saying yes. So we're getting, no, they're not doing too bad. On a hit rate of a comic company, that's not too bad.
Well, I'm going to give, I think, you know, I think if you dive into the Black Crown Quarterly, I think you will find something. I don't think it's necessarily, I think it's such a smorgasbord that you will find something in there of entertainment value, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, we know it's an expensive game reading comics. We know that, don't we?
Oh, yeah, it certainly is. Yeah.
Well, maybe not so much at the moment because nobody's making any, but there you go.
Everybody's giving them away for free. Now's the time
to get into comics. Yeah. Next one I've got is not one that's not, for me, not specifically part of the Black Crown Empire, but is quoted on their Comixology page as one of them. And I've got a feeling, I should have looked this up, but I've got a feeling this was kickstarted, and it's Femme Magnifique.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have you read this one?
So I haven't read it, but my daughter did, and
she
enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So I think for, you know, she's at the time we picked up a copy, and actually, no, I think I won a copy by retweeting one of Shelley Bond's tweets or something.
Nice. Oh, good stuff.
So really nice. Yeah. So she sent it along with a few other little bits and pieces, and I gave it to my daughter who read it, and she really enjoyed it. And I think, you know, for what it is, it's not a comic per se. It's sort of a collection of biographies, of
three-page biographies, as I understand it. They're each three pages.
Yeah,
kind of like, I think that's an interesting thing, all based around women who've sort of triumphed over things, or, you know, the sort of standouts in their field, that sort of thing. Oh, that's, it's kind of cool.
Exactly.
What was the art like? Did you notice?
I thought it was good. Yeah, there was a good mixture in there, I think, as well, because it's not every artist did the same thing. So I think it was a collection of artists. I can't remember.
I think so. Yeah, all different stuff.
And I honestly really love, personally, I actually might have to go grab it off her and take a look at it, but I love anthologies where you can see a collection of comics. You know, one of my favorite type of stories for Marvel and DC was when they would gather together a whole bunch of different artists and give each one three pages or something, you know?
You
flick through, and because, you know, that was why I bought comics, was for the art, because I'm that shallow, you know.
I just bought it for the girls.
Well, you can't do that anymore, Tony.
That's true.
You have to give more back now.
Okay, so given that I didn't read that one, I have to say I've had a flick through it. It's let's just say it's probably not made for me.
No, I think, but if you were talking about my daughter, who was 14 and 15, I think that's perfect for that age range. I think they really nailed the audience on that one.
Yeah, good. Next one, you notice I've gone alphabetically. Next one is House Amok, which is written by Christopher Sabella, art by Sean McManus. I think I read an issue. I don't remember it at all.
You didn't read it?
I think.
This was one that I didn't read in the initial run, so I went back and did a read of it.
Okay.
So the conceit of this is, it's a family. It's kind of difficult to describe, but it's a family who believes in a certain conspiracy that there are, like, what do they call them? Slippers or something? There are monsters that are controlling the world. So it's kind of a family that believes in sort of the stuff that would be in the territory of David Icke, you know, except it's its own particular thing. Right. And so it really revolves around two twin girls who are maybe, I don't know, seven or eight, And one of those particular twins is the storyteller. And it's about how they build out a bus to be sort of a moving home, and they end up roaring across the countryside, causing death and dismay.
Oh. Excuse me, sorry to interrupt you there, Cliff. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to pause for an advert.
Ooh, yes.
Do you like having sex that makes you feel like you're looking down on yourself from above, totally disgusted and wondering how it all came to this? Shagging a trucker up against a pallet in a motorway services? I know I do. Do you like going home smelling of sweat, jeers and cucumber-flavoured lube? I know I do. Why not become a prozzy? There you go, that's that advert. Over. Thank you. They're back. Good guys. Back for another advert this week. Sorry, you were saying, I rudely interrupted you with our sponsor. Yeah.
I'm going to need a minute. Okay, all right.
It's all money, isn't it? I mean,
I love the frozzy ones. Trucker. Oh my god. Yeah. Cuz I walked past truckers the other day
did,
and I didn't have the
Yeah. All right, sorry, my sponsor got it from your video that you sent me with you shouting.
The sponsor.
Do you want a prozzy? Yeah, it's nice.
Do you truckers, do you want a prozzy?
I'm going to play that in the next episode. I think I'll play that.
Yes.
Who have we got next week? We've got Johnny Cannon and Dave Robertson. I might play it to Dave. Will like that. I think I'll play it to Dave. He'll like that.
I was very disappointed because I did write in for the 8-part course on how to be a prozzy. and I only received 4 yeah. from the Esmond School of Prozzydom. Yeah. Prozzy Uni. The University of
Prozzydom. Prozzies.
I do.
Yeah. I think we'll go back to
sorry.
And now back to our regular programming.
All right, okay.
Yeah, good. But thank you for the support for supporting that sponsor, Cliff.
I'm very glad
to
do
we've
that.
Got him a few customers since he came for the hosting.
well,
at least it's not fucking done. Squarespace or Blue Penny or ever shy
Wix.
People. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, Angel Fire.
Yeah, DCBS, whatever that is. I don't know. Okay, so House of Mock was by Christopher Sabella. Have you read anything else by Christopher?
I have not, no. Is it good?
He did a book called High Crimes, which is very good.
About
a sort of detective thing around people chopping people's hands off to recover bodies after climbing Mount Everest. Mm. And yeah, really, really interesting. I think it was an early Comixology-only book. I think then got published, but I'm going to say Boom, but I'm probably wrong. But yeah, really interesting. He fell foul a little bit, didn't he, last year? Because didn't he make his own Judge Dredd badges, but put other things on them, and it all turned into
I don't know. Oh wow, you're really. Oh yeah. No, this is turfing up the dirt here.
Yeah, I think he bootlegged some Dredd. I don't know. Something. Yeah, usual Twitter stuff.
Well, yeah, Twitter can get angry about so many things.
Yeah, they love to get angry, don't they? So you were saying about House of Mock, you didn't enjoy it, or you did, or?
No, okay, so enjoying it is maybe a little too strong a word. I found it disturbing and very. It was well told in terms of, you know, kind of. As I'll say with all of the Black Crown imprints, I really do believe they could have used a little bit different editing. Okay. I think, you know, maybe a mix of editors would have been a little more beneficial, but I understand Shelley was doing the editing for everything.
Yeah, so I understand.
House of Mock was one of the stronger titles. It's definitely its own arc. I mean, it concludes pretty definitively. It was a really kind of disturbingly horrific sort of descent into kind of this family's madness. So I enjoyed that. The art was top notch. I loved the art.
I should have stuck with it. I think really I got it confused with Lodger for some reason.
You might have. House of Mock. I think I did too as well. But House of Mock is very definitely its own tale.
Yeah, it's just the covers, I
recommend
I think,
reading
a bit,
it.
Yeah, I think maybe it was the covers confused me a little bit, I think.
I think it was the best told of all the stories.
Oh, really? Okay, sure. Interesting stuff.
I did enjoy it. I thought it had a very definitive arc. There was one little bit. I think there was a story arc of the sun I found a little bit shoehorned in. But overall, I found it very readable, and I really loved the art. Yeah, for sure.
Nice. Oh, lovely. I might give that another go then. That's Another one from my list. Good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Next one up. We're doing well here, Geezer. Next one up is... now, this one I was all in. As soon as I heard about it, all in. This is the one they announced at NYCC. This is the one I went and spoke to the writer about because I absolutely love his stuff. And it just sounded straight away up my street. And whether it was later on, I'll keep back until I hear from you. But it was Kid Lobotomy. So the writer on Kid Lobotomy was Pete Milligan.
Pete Milligan.
The artist was Tess Fowler. It was their launch, what they describe as their debut and launch title. It was a story, King Lear, basically, I suppose, is to put it like that. It's a boy who's looking to take over a hotel from his father, but the hotel is far from normal. He's had a lobotomy or a number of lobotomies, and he's decided that he should be giving them as well. I mean, Milligan is a maniac in his writing in all the best ways. But what did you think?
So I'm a Pete Milligan fan, and I have been since the days of 2000 AD, and you know, and also didn't he write in for Deadline? And
yeah, he did. Just a few of his titles are Screamer, which was a sort of proto Vertigo book before Vertigo was out. Skin, which we talked about on the podcast when
published
by Tundra, and I have to say, Skin is an absolute classic. I think
it is.
I think it should be spoken about with Watchmen and Dark Knight, and all those books. Johnny Nemo, Batman, he created the character Azrael, as I understand it, and also X-Force that became the brilliant Ecstatics. He continues to this day. His comics writing has been 40 years, pretty much, I think, as far as I can see. Very imaginative, very strange, when he wants to be, I think.
I think, I think criminally underrepresented as the influence that he's had on comics.
Yeah.
I think he was one of those sort of formative British writers who were part of that 80s revolution in comics who's sort of, I mean, maybe, I don't, you know, I don't know the industry as well as you do, but I think that he's one of those people who should be spoken of in the same breaths of as Frank Miller and people like that.
Yeah.
With his imagination.
No, definitely. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, there's a few British writers who came, I suppose, almost on the second wave, didn't they? They were a bit behind Gibbons and Moore. Who were just so interesting. There's just some really interesting stuff going on.
Right.
I love the idea. I was all in. And I bought the first four issues, I think. First three issues, maybe. And I wanted something. And it's terribly selfish of me, but I wanted something different from the art, I suppose. The art is a little bit newer, a little bit hipper, a little bit cooler for me. I wanted something like, I'm going to say like a Dave McKean, somebody like that on the art, something darker and...
A little more Sandman-like.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, so the style for this was way too reminiscent of kind of the Hewlett-Bond style. For me, it needed more of a horror artist on it and a horror feel to it, I think, because it just seemed a little bit too, how should I put it? A little bit too comfortable.
Yeah. I wanted something more dangerous from it. I think of it, after we mentioned Skin, I'd love McCarthy on it. I think he would have just gone nuts on it.
You know what? Actually, it did seem like a kind of poorer Brendan McCarthy.
Yeah, there's a little bit that with a little bit of the. I don't know. Everyone should have been a threat in that book. Everyone visually should have been sinister and scary and a threat. Yeah, even Kid Lobotomy himself, but they didn't. There seems to be something. I don't know. Just not edgy enough for me about it. I don't know.
The story itself is utterly surreal.
Right.
It's almost incomprehensible, and I think that probably was sort of one of the problems with this being like the flagship comic.
I can see that being one of the problems as to why the sales weren't amazing for it as well, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, when you combine it with kind of Euthanauts and everything else, I think that it made Black Crown a little bit too inaccessible to too many people.
That's a good point.
And Kid Lobotomy was probably the least accessible of all of the books insofar as the story.
I mean, it's fair to say, just to jump in here, we're saying this in retrospect, aren't we? We've never launched a comic company.
Oh my
do you know what
God,
I mean?
No.
So how do we know things? But this, just from a point of view of a reader, this is how we felt about it, which I think occasionally is an important thing. But yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, and this is no disrespect to the creators or anyone else. But I mean, the kind of the delicate nuances of creating stuff like this and making it appealing and entertaining.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm certainly not an authority on that. And but, you know, there's a degree of, I think that there is a degree to which I think these could have been made more accessible works.
Yeah.
And
we're
I
mean, we're saying this, and we're people who came up on Vertigo, at the early days of Vertigo.
Yes.
You know, we should be, sadly, we should be the crowd for this.
And if we should
if we're
be.
Being turned
we should
off by
be.
It, you know.
Well, you know, and I think, the issue is, I think there was a sort of, there's a deep intellectualism to the whole thing, right? This was kind of very sort of, it was very self-indulgent, a lot of these works. And that's where I say, I think, you know, a little bit of stronger reins on the editing maybe could have pulled this back into a more populist kind of title. Or, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, this clearly was a playground for the artists and creators. And I think Shelley clearly wanted it to be a playground for the artists and creators to sort of experiment and be a little bit more different. But, you know.
Which is not a bad thing. It's an incredibly great thing to do. I mean, I love the fact that is just. You're right. I think you hit it on the head there. If Eve Stranger was the first book out of the gate on this, people would have been going nuts for it.
Or Punk's Not Dead. I think if Punk's Not Dead had led the way, that was an incredibly accessible work. You know, but I understand Pete Milligan is he's a very popular writer and people love the kind of stuff that he does. But this just went a little bit too far into that dreamscape. And, you know, the story was just a wee bit too much relying on its own internal dynamics, its own internal physics.
I mean, were we in search of Shade the Changing Man with it, you know?
Yeah. I think it was trying to capture the best of Vertigo here. But what it hadn't established was a sort of an ongoing universe in which this story could eventually emerge. I think you could have worked towards a Kid Lobotomy that would have been very successful had the Black Crown universe been given a little bit more time to evolve. A little bit more time to breathe. And I think you have to walk readers into something as challenging as House of Mock or as challenging as Kid Lobotomy, because you know one of the things you've got to do is you've got to entertain people enough to get them to stick with you,
definitely.
For whatever reason. There is an element of entertainment that really does need to come into comics and all kinds of media, and unless you really can provide people with that sort of emotionally resonant feeling of being pleased when they've engaged with your material, you know, and not necessarily turned off because they're sort of sickened by it or confused by it, or they just can't get their head around it, or it makes them feel stupid, then you lose them. You know, and sort of being right off the bat, jumping into the deep end with Kid Lobotomy, I think it was kind of a strategic error of marketing.
I think as well, and we talk a bit about this where I work, but I think you need in order for a company to stay and to be successful and actually to sell a few books, you need to build a community, and you need to build what used to be called fans, didn't it? You know, now it's called Facebook groups and, you know, Twitter hashtags and stuff like that. And you need
an audience.
I think I'm an audience who are prepared to talk about it everywhere, you know.
And advocates.
And I don't think this was the right book to get everyone round. I think there was a bit of a sort of masturbatory My Chemical Romance thing going on.
So, you know, it was desperately trying to please a specific niche of person. And I think that was probably a bit of a problem with the entirety of the Black Crown range, is that it was too much of a cliquey. Well, we could get into that a little bit more when we talk about it more in general. But for me, it I'm an old 50-year-old guy, and I grew up around similar influences. I think that Shelley and Philip, you know, yeah. Well, they were producing some of my most profound influences, yeah, you know, while yeah. I was growing up. And, you know, the whole of the Black Crown line and Kid Lobotomy in particular is trying to, it relies too heavily on an influential but relatively narrow era of British comics, you know, back in the 80s, yeah. As its inspiration. And these, you know, and it's trying to get a whole new generation of creators who, you know, I hate to say this, but it's like the dyed hair, tattoo and piercing and green lipstick crowd, you know, very sort of, I know, you know, it's not the most diverse group to be sort of producing stuff.
Yeah. It's a funny one, isn't it? Who do we sell our comics to?
Audience.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, or do we just make good comics and hope they sell? There's the middle ground there somewhere. But
okay, yeah. So I think you're exactly right, and I think with independent comics, you know, for smaller creators, this is something that you could go to a conference and sell quite easily. But when you're talking about, you know, a relatively large component of a relatively large comic book company, IDW, yeah. You know, you're really trying to have as broad an appeal as possible, because you really want to actually, it's not just a passion game for you. It is, there is a bottom line. You do need to sell comics to be able yeah. to be viable.
And for a period of time, I'm not sure at the moment, but IDW were the third biggest company, you know, bigger than Image. So, yeah, so they were putting a lot of faith in this. Should we move on? Let's move on to the next one, because we're getting too general.
Yes.
And I've got a few general points I want to pose to you in a minute as well.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Let's do that.
So we've got three left. We've got Lodger, which I have to admit to not having read either.
I read it. Yep, I did. Yep.
David and Maria Lapham. I'm a big fan of Stray Bullets by David, so I don't know why I didn't. I just found the trade dress and it just wasn't pulling me in. There was nothing there that... it's a crime drama, as far as I know about it.
Yeah.
It's got another single image of a young female on the cover, like House of Mock.
So it's a young woman who I believe has somebody she loves has been killed by somebody who is a serial killer, who
right.
also turns out to be a travel blocker. And
sorry,
the
what? A travel blogger. Oh my God! Talk about glamorous.
Well, yeah. Talk about sort of trying to appeal to a particular niche of people. But anyhow. it's like, you know, I don't know, you'd like to travel Instagram or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's the story. And I did read it all the way through. I found it okay, but it had a very, very strange wrap-up.
Okay.
A very surreal kind of where I was not quite getting why it wrapped up in that particular way, because it just went very strange at the end.
Ah,
I think there was body swapping and metamorphosis, and I have to admit I was not of a mind where I was reading it super, super deeply, pondering over each panel and the meaning. I was just sort of shooting through,
right.
And I hit that ending and I was like, oh, and stopped for a minute and put it down and immediately was like, oh, okay.
Okay.
I don't get that. I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. And
I
had the same.
Or were you reading it in floppies?
I read.
You like that? I just said that for you. Yeah.
No, thank you. I do love the floppies, but digitally. So I was sort of scanning through page after page of it fairly quickly, and maybe if I go back and read it again, there might be a little bit more to it.
Okay.
I don't know. And I might actually, if I was more attentive to actually reading it in a critical mind. But, you know, once again, it's like I turn to comics a lot of times just really to
see the art,
not be super challenged, to look at the art.
Sometimes and, we like that,
and
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are challenging comic books, but I feel like I have to take a run at them. You know, I have to energize myself before engaging with them.
Yeah.
And this, I think maybe the whole of Black Crown's range is at an intellectual level where I felt like I really needed to bring my sort of my A game critical thinking skills to.
Yeah. It's not a book for the train home knackered on a Friday night. I think it's that
No. So it's like it's not like a Jeffrey Archer, right? It's more of a James Joyce.
Yeah, it's not a Jilly Cooper. Yeah, I get you. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's no Jilly Cooper to this. It's not like a quick slam bang and there's the floppy. It's you got to bring some you got to bring some, I think, critical thinking skills to the table when you engage with Black Crown.
So
Lodger was one of those where it was like, it clearly had a intellectual level to which I was not prepared to engage.
Okay, maybe with. One day when I get some time in my life, I'll throw myself in and put aside a couple of hours and give it a read.
But it was like one of those kind of wanky independent movies where, you know, it was, you feel like, okay, well, that was clearly made by the creator purely for the creator, who just felt they had something deep and meaningful to say that doesn't necessarily resonate with anybody else.
Okay. Well, there's a question later, which is just one or two words that will, I'll be posing to you that will sum up possibly what we're talking about here. So let's move on. Excuse me. Can I interrupt this with our next advert?
Please do.
Do you love life on the open road? Feeling the wind in your hair as you drive down country roads and then pulling over into scenic picnic spots? Then dogging is the life for you. Roll down that window and give, or brackets, or receive, close brackets, oral, whilst a crowd of men watch. Brilliant. Go dogging.
Brilliant. Go dogging.
Not sponsored by the RAC. There you go. That was our new sponsor.
Thank the RSPCA. Not that kind of dog.
Yep. Not that there you kind go. Of... It's all money in it. Right.
Don't do it now, though.
No.
Social distancing. 6 feet apart.
Yep.
Please observe from at least 6 feet away.
Well, you could do it if you were just watching, couldn't you?
You could, yeah.
So next book I've got on the list, Mr. C, is Punk's Not Dead, a favourite both of ours. We've already talked about it. David Barnett on writing.
Yes.
Martin Simmons on art. Two miniseries. This is it the longest running book of theirs? I'm going to say it probably is with both of them.
I believe so, yeah. Yeah, clearly.
Sid Vicious returns, is found in a bathroom at the airport.
Probably Sid Vicious.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we never got that clarified, did we? A men's room. He's a ghost that only certain people can see. They have an almost like, if anyone remembers the Avengers from the 60s before the Marvel one, a John Steed kind of Avengers-esque spy team who investigate the paranormal involved in it.
Scepter, Jenny and Emma Peel.
Yes. Yeah, it was a bit sort of Mod Squad kind of touch to them.
Yeah.
I would never ever say that one of them was clearly meant to be an older version of Shelley. And Martin told me never to say that, so I will never say that.
Don't ever say that.
Yeah, but it's it was just a great road trip book that with fully fleshed out characters,
and a coming of age book as well. You know,
yeah,
it's perfect. Yeah,
yeah, I really enjoyed that, and then I recommend. I've reviewed it a few times, recommended it on nonstop, and it's. You don't have to be into music to like it, although it helps. I know Dave Barnett and mine are both big music fans. I sort of swap musical albums or recommendations from both of them. But it's two miniseries, two trades, good stuff. Get it while you can. Different.
Yeah.
But then again,
absolutely.
So I'm going to ask you this question now, and I'm going to ask you it before we get onto the final comic. Is
all right.
Do we think that Black Crown suffered from being too self-indulgent?
Oh, I think the answer is clearly yes.
Okay.
Clearly yes, for a number of different reasons. Yeah, yeah. I think that was absolutely its number one problem.
Okay, right. And self-indulgent from the point of view of the Bonds? Do you think they were the leads?
Okay, so I got to say this that with absolute love for what Shelley was trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also I'm sure Philip, I mean, because, you know, I think the problem was that it was way too much Shelley and Philip, you know?
Right.
I think, you know, I'd got to feel like, okay, my own feeling was that they were trying to recapture a wave of cool that had long since was a product of its time and place and could not be repeated.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was redolent of that particular time in the 80s where, you know, there was magazines and comics that were of a particular style and genre that were very, very British and were breaking ground because they were sort of revolutionary and of their time. You know, ID, The Face, yeah. Those, you know, and then Deadline, Paradox, you know, Crisis, and A1,
yeah,
you know, Carousel, yeah. Johnny Nemo, and Strange Days, and Tank Girl, Love and Rockets in America, and Ghost World.
Oh, mate. Yeah, good list. Yeah, that's so evocative of a period of my life, you know.
Yeah, right. And it was a specific, not long, very narrow niche period. It didn't happen for very long.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and it gave birth to a lot of creators who went on to become extraordinarily, well, I mean, they were influential at the time and they drove a whole new approach to comics, but it moved on very, very quickly. You know,
yeah.
So you got your Brendan McCarthy's and you got your Jamie Hewlett's and Philip Bonds and Grant Morrison, Brett Ewins, all of those guys. You Steve know, they Dillon. Came out. Yeah. Of, yeah. Steve Dillon, all came out of a very kind of. They all came around at a particular time. And I know when you had Brendan McCarthy on the show, you know, I think he talked a lot about that time.
Yeah.
And how it was that particular, their interactions that led to this particular strain of kind of semi-punk, sort of goth, very transgressive, alternative styles,
yeah.
You know, in art and storytelling. They were out to push back on kind of that staid sort of British comic. It had become sort of moribund and a little bit sort of trapped in a rut, and they pushed back against that, you know, kind of that sort of feel to it was very alternative.
Yeah,
and,
it was,
you know,
revolutionary, anti-establishment. There was the squats and the house parties and the mm-hmm. drugs and the music and the sort of riots that occurred, you know, you had the poll
exactly.
tax riot, for example, and England was, you know, cool Britannia, England and London especially had that mm-hmm. about it, didn't it? It really did. It was such an era of
exactly,
and along with austerity comes creativity, is what they say, isn't it? And I think we had a bit of that there. And you're right, though; those people were creating such just original stuff, you know.
Yeah, and there was a degree of oppression that led to it as well.
Yeah, that's
And I mean, that's what I think, you know, you see, you sort of see the roots in V for Vendetta and Summer Moore's work, and you definitely see that in Skin, you know?
Yeah.
That sort of, it was a feeling of, if we don't, you know, youthful
angriness.
Revolution,
yeah,
really anger. Was. And it was anger that came out of a particular economic situation with a very, there were two authoritarian style governments in place at the time. You know, you had Reagan and you had Thatcher, and then you had the Falklands War. You know, it was all going to shit. And that was very much reflected in the art of and music and just the zeitgeist
I mean,
of the time.
From sort of Ned's Atomic Dustbin through to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Oasis and, you know, that sort of thing.
It was
electricity. And do you know what, kids? It was before the internet was widespread as well.
Yeah. And, you know, that sort of Time Out, you know, magazines like Time Out, The Face, ID.
Enemy. Yeah, yeah.
Enemy. These were where kind of I think people got their ideas about the time, you know, and that was bleeding over into magazines like, you know, 2000 AD was very much at the time kind of
Crisis,
dystopian.
Toxic and, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, the writing of, I mean, Irvin Welsh and Trainspotting, you know, and Heroin and all this sort of these undercurrents that people were mining for their artistic interpretation to put out in the world. And that was very much the feel that I think, you know, Shelley and Philip clearly lived through that.
Yeah.
And I think were to a degree, maybe nostalgically longing for that, as you do as you get to a certain age, as I certainly do.
Yeah.
But I mean, the problem is time marches on and you can't repeat the kind of cultural underpinnings that led to that period of British, that explosion in British creativity.
I think
when you're 50.
Yeah. I think it also stops accessibility from other people as well, from people who don't have that as a touchstone. I think you just see it as old blokes comics. I mean, I wrote a little list and tried to think who each comic was aimed at. And when you, if I was trying to put myself, if I could, in the feet of the people making, I think Punk's Not Dead is for 50-year-old men, 40 to 55-year-old men, isn't it?
Heavy on nostalgia, right?
I mean,
But you know what? I think the thing is that it was accessible enough in the way the story was told that you didn't have to just be a 50-year-old man to get it. You actually felt kind of the kid's story as, you know, it was very much that sort of trope of a child sort of comes to understand and see the world in a different way.
For me and you, man, I agree completely. For me and you, that's definitely the case, but it just wasn't reflected in sales. I looked it up. I know Comicron isn't the most the most effective way of looking at sales, but it certainly is a reflection of what they are, and very low thousands.
Yeah, I understand. But, you know, I think it was probably one of the more accessible stories.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And definitely was more of the one. It definitely had more commercial potential to it. I mean, when you look at it, it would definitely make kind of a fun movie.
Yeah, or a Netflix series of some kind.
And, you know, that sort of interplay between people looking at that and being like, well, who the bloody hell is this Johnny Rotten character? You know, these days. I mean, we know who he is. But I think there's a degree to which, you know, that there is a certain amount of nostalgia mining that you can do. And I think Punk's Not Dead did it in a way that it didn't sort of hold your mouth open and cram in the sentimentality with a spoon. It was sort of very cleverly and wittily done, you know. But yet there's other elements of Black Crown's oeuvre that really did just.
I mean, you got to remember, I work at university and I was speaking to one of the girls I work with, and she she's 24 and she didn't know who William Shatner was. Obviously I just cut her out of my life immediately, but you know, we forget these, probably people, you know, they don't know Johnny Rotten is, they don't know Sid Vicious is, they don't know, they might know Paul Weller is, maybe, but then again, where's Paul Weller been in the last 10 years? You know, there's all this sort of thing.
Yeah,
it's a strange one. It's
We do far too much of it these days. I think sentimentality of nostalgia
I've just downloaded.
Well, it's just
bored sitting in my house over during the lockdown. I've just downloaded from Sky Arts the making of a load of different albums. You know, and I was looking at, there's one by The Band, which is, it's like 45 years old. There's one by Lou Reed, which is almost the same, you know, and I'm thinking, who honestly would be interested in these, you know? And my Sky Planner is full of this old bloke stuff now, you know?
All right. Well, let me step back a bit, because I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
So there's sentimentality that is initially, I think, there was a lot of mining of sentimentality in order to sort of produce new stuff. And I think a lot of the early stuff was done well, you know, let me step back on that and say you can mine sentimentality well, you can mine nostalgia well, and you can mine nostalgia really fucking badly. A lot of the Marvel movies, I think they did that really, really well.
Yeah.
They took a lot of the classic stuff. They did enough fan service. They had enough sentimentality for the original source materials that they actually produced it in a way that was quite watchable and actually resonated.
It was
excitement. Now, Picard, okay, for anybody who's a fan of The Next Generation, and that wasn't that long ago, you know, I think Picard was done really well,
where they brought back the character. No spoilers. Yeah.
Okay, no spoilers.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm a huge Next Gen fan. I'm a huge fan of them all, but I mean, mind you, Next Gen's what, 30 years old? Is it?
Yeah. So, but yeah, it is. And I don't know, it ended like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, with the movies. So it's rememberable enough. So I think those types, that's done well.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, what's happened is there's been this rush. People have seen how successful these nostalgic throwbacks have been. And there's just been this huge market-driven rush now to try and cram sentimentality and nostalgia into everything.
Yeah.
And not a lot of it's done really well. I mean, I know I'm burned out on it. I will only pick and choose a few things that I actually like if it's overly full of sort of throwbacks to my time as a kid. So, you know, for me, there's a lot of Black Crown that I'm like, yeah, okay, that was a great idea. You know, that mining this idea of kind of a little bit more of a transgressive comic that's a bit more challenging. Okay, you know, on paper, in the manifesto, you know, that might work. But in actuality, it just it kind of didn't, you know.
It's weird, isn't it? How do you launch a comic company now, though? It's such a strange time for it. You know, you need a key to unlock people, don't you? I think sometimes you need a hook to pull them in.
Yeah.
And
I think, you know,
this was tried and didn't perhaps work financially. It didn't, obviously, because the company only lasted slightly over 2 years. Yeah, it's a funny one. Let's do the last issue, then I've got a couple of questions more for
all
you.
Right.
Okay, so the last comic is one, if anyone read Never Mind Anything, the blog, the Honest Blog today, I did a review of it, and it's a book called Marilyn Manor, written by Mags Visaggio, who we sat next to in a pub in New York.
We were very close.
About five months ago. Yeah, yeah.
We were within pint-chucking distance.
With the Mighty Harris next to us.
With the Great Dane. Yeah.
And Marley Zacone is the artist. It's now, I think, tactically and... from a, let's be honest, a slightly wrong-footed approach, they released a first issue for sale that they must have at that point knew there wouldn't have been a second issue or maybe possibly a third issue of, which I find dishonest. I find dishonest. Yeah, I find it slightly unethical to do that. I think if you know that there's a comic which is clearly a book that is meant to continue into another one, then are you right-footed to release it? Now, if you read it, if you see the physical copy, I believe it has only IDW written on the cover, but it is available for sale through the Black Crown imprint section of IDW on Comixology. So I'm unsure, to be fair, who is responsible for the release of it. But it's I don't know about that. I think that's wrong. I don't think that's particularly honest.
It seems a little deceptive.
Yeah.
Right. I think if you're going to commit, you need to commit to at least releasing more than one.
Yeah. And I went into it knowing that when I went into it, because I'd read about it and I wanted something to read. I hadn't read of Black Crowns because I knew we were talking about it tonight. And I've probably read about just over half of their product. But I haven't read this one. So I tried it. But if somebody just bought it on a whim because they like Mag Fazaggio's writing, for example, they wouldn't necessarily know that it's not just a one-off comic or it's, you know, maybe reads the summaries on Comixology. Do they really? You know, you look at the previous pages.
No.
Yeah.
No.
It is the story about the daughter of the president whose father, I think it's her father, had an affair with Marilyn Monroe. Thus, she's called Marilyn. She idolizes Madonna and Monroe. She finds a secret corridor underneath the White House. Oh, shocker. With a sex room in it, shocker, and they have a party, and that's it.
A rager.
That's right.
They take over the whole White House in order to have a huge sort of rave.
It's described by Mags herself as being a new romantic comic, inspired by new romanticism. I checked. Mags was a toddler probably when new romantics were out. It looks to me all the while as if someone got a couple of copies of Smash Hits, worked out that Adamant and Billy Idol were probably about the same time. There's actually a line in it which says, "Oh, Billy Idol and Adamant are over there," and I'm like, just groaned with pain.
Yeah.
There's a few fashions in it that look like they were from the era, but it's just.
It's painful, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's painful. Yeah. It was painful to read. I think the way I described it to you over WhatsApp was that if I wanted to read Jinty, I would buy Jinty magazine.
If only Jinty was that good. But it's almost like they've tried to add sex and drugs to Jinty.
So here we get back to this talk of nostalgia mining, right?
Yeah.
And the problem is they gave it to somebody who didn't really understand what all that was about in the first place.
Yeah.
So you have a writer who is looking at Duran Duran videos and thinking that she really understands kind of where this culture, this nexus came from. And, you know, honestly, I lived through it and I'm not sure I really understand it.
Yeah, me neither.
And then, you know, handing that to somebody and saying, here, develop a story around how cool the 80s were and new romantics.
And she compares it to a John Hughes movie and I'm like, you're not getting it.
No, it wasn't a John. No, I mean, well, when you think one of the conceits in it is that this the girl's best friend, Marilyn's best friend, is supposedly possessed by the spirit of Abe Lincoln.
And but that's so heavily handed, agenda driven. It's
ridiculous.
It's the wrong subject to get on because people will have a go at us, but it's just obvious.
Okay, so no. Let's tackle this.
Right.
Okay, so the diversity in comics is a worthy and noble goal.
Yes.
People should be reading comics that accurately represents who they are, and they should be shown in a way that helps empower them in thinking that they're not unusual, and that they are welcome.
Yeah, there
and
should be comics for everyone.
Embrace.
There
should
it.
Be
yeah.
comics for people who want to do that. Now, there is a point at which you can do that in a storyline in a very natural way, where these things emerge in ways that make sense, then that actually mirror the way that storylines emerge in real life, you know, and families in real life and how those things are represented. But then you get stories like this where it tries to shoehorn in everything.
Yeah,
and give everything to everybody, but gives in doing so gives nothing. It's empty. It's vacuous. It comes across as inauthentic, and at the end of the day, that just is insulting to people.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
who should be represented by these books.
Yeah, and there's what's the I forget the name of the pop star they refer to. Oh,
I don't think I got that far.
Okay. So there's it's sort of she's in love with this pop star who turns up. He's another. He looks a bit like a cross between Sid and My Chemical Romance.
I think he's going to trash the White House or whatever, right?
And he's called. I'm just seeing if I can find the. He's called Harry Sykes. Now, oh my God! And I think I wrote in the review. Oh God, help us! Who wrote this? 12-year-olds. I mean, it's just like this sort of. I'm almost embarrassed to say it. It's this sort of embarrassing Harry Styles reference. It's just really. Oh God.
Yeah. You know. It's utterly conceived in a way that is insulting kind of to the culture that it's trying to represent back then.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's not realistic. There's no truth to it to me. Yeah.
No, and I mean the way, the sort of the story, which is ham-fisted at best, but, you know, she's being followed around by a videographer. So it's trying to cram in modern culture, this whole modern selfie culture, into a story about the 80s and just missing everything about the 80s that made the 80s kind of, well, I wouldn't say cool when you live it, but, you know.
Yeah.
That you can represent an era, you know, Stranger Things, right? Represented that period, certainly from an American perspective, but in a really well thought out way.
I mean, it only encourages me to write better in my new series, Sonya. The true story.
True story of Sonya.
Warts and all, Sonya.
I was Adamant's love slave.
Daily
Mirror, something or other.
Didn't he allegedly go in a pub in Kentish Town and fire a gun or something? Isn't that allegedly?
It was not alleged. He did it.
Right, okay.
He was going through a mental health breakdown at the time.
Right.
And he was very paranoid and apparently did go into a pub. He's better now.
Good.
I'm glad to say.
Good to know.
Because I got to admit, I was a huge Adamant fan. I had like every vinyl single and everything.
I remember being slightly off-put by the fact that Diana Dawes was meant to be slightly saucy in that video, and I just wasn't getting it.
Yeah, you're a little worried the way she sort of marches at you and, you know.
Yeah.
Prince Charming, that's was the video.
Yeah.
Okay, so,
general questions, but go on, mate, sorry, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, before the piracy and everything else, he was, in fact, a punk band, a la kind of, you know, like Punk's Not Dead, that kind of, he came out of that scene.
Yeah.
Anyway,
oh, cool.
Carry on.
Nice one.
Carry on.
Okay,
questions
so a couple of questions for you. So we've been through every book there, so we're going to try and sum up what we think were the successes. Before that, though, I just want to say, pose one question at you. So, at the point that this was conceived, Shelley had left Vertigo, but Karen Berger had also left. They were both creating their own imprints that were very Vertigo-esque in different ways.
Right.
Was it too late at this point? Vertigo was on the slide by this point, I think. Is it too late to replace Vertigo? What about now? Is it too late?
Well, I think Vertigo recognized that it was too late for Vertigo.
Yeah.
You know, that's why we don't have a Vertigo anymore.
It's a shame. It
is a shame. You know, but once upon a time, these kind of imprints were, for people who read comics, they would develop lines of comics that were a bit more challenging and intellectually thought through and had slightly more adult themed stories. The problem is, I think the only people who are really buying comics these days are people like you and I, the old guys. You know, that they used to be for kids.
Yeah.
They used to be for cool teens.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that period throughout the 80s where comics revolutionized, and then it was taken out and shot by the comics that came out in the 90s. But anyhow.
But don't forget, the Vertigo was kind of the other side of comics back then, wasn't it? I know. we slag the 90s. I'm responsible for it more than anyone else. But when you look at it, we also had that side of things as well going on. Yeah.
That was the thing. There was a representative diversity of different kinds of comics that were well branded that you could then pick and choose. You know, I mean, there were the people who loved the Jim Lee, Rob Liefeld stuff. And then there were the pretentious art school twats like myself who, you know, would read The Watchmen and Elektra and, you know, the Epic imprint. And that was kind of, you know, but there was much more diversity in the comics field itself that you could pick and choose from whatever you wanted.
Yeah.
You know, there was a menu from which you could choose the kind of comics that you would be into.
Yeah.
Karen
and Shelley were responsible for that. You know,
right,
they shaped
right.
a lot of childhoods. It's, you know.
Yeah, unquestionable.
Yeah.
Their influence on it was unquestionable. But I think the problem is that the market reduction in who's actually buying comics these days means that there's only sort of a very niche group of people who are really still sort of collecting. And it's getting smaller.
I think they're actually maybe biting their nose off to spite their face a little bit with that, because we've seen the decline of single issue sales a little bit over the last year. Certainly the bottom 50 have declined sales wise. The top 10 of, you know, with event books and stuff have stayed fairly buoyant, but we've seen certainly the decline of trade paperbacks. So the collection of issues is trade paperbacks that has declined. But what we have seen the rise of is, graphic novels. Now they should have diversified and just moved into that sort of model, you know.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think what probably would have been a better model for Black Crown would have been something like the TKO model, where, you know, it's a curated bunch of comic books, sort of a la Netflix, where you can just get them all at once, instead of being a series driven sort of more traditional monthly model of comic books. Because, you know, the problem with Black Crown is that they clearly thought through the world building before they ever launched any of the comic books. The issue is that you've got to buy people into wanting to understand that world, to collect the books in order to sort of appreciate that kind of work.
Yeah.
And the way you do that is you've got to sort of hook them in. There needs to be a little bit of bait on the line. I think one of the issues Black Crown definitely suffered from was it appealed to way too narrow a niche of people.
Yeah.
You know, it's intellectual, slightly snooty, very self. I mean, setting aside the self-indulgence, I think, you know, it was they wanted to bring on board younger but more kind of alternative creators and give them a bit more of a
And I think they maybe gave them too much to do.
Way too much. And they gave them way too much leash as well on their stories.
I think if you look at Teenie Howard got two books out of it. She got Assassinistas and Euthanauts. I think she did some stuff in Black Crown Quarterly. And neither of them landed for me, writing-wise, certainly.
No. And Teenie Howard's not a bad writer. I mean, you know, the problem was that I think, again, I think Shelley's a phenomenal editor. I just don't think she necessarily, I don't know whether or not she had too strong of a rein or not enough. You know, yeah. I wasn't involved in those in the room when those decisions were made, but it gets I just get the sense that there was a degree, there was a lot of stuff that was shoehorned into the stories that didn't need to be there.
Yeah.
There wasn't like necessarily a strong enough storytelling direction on many of the works. And, you know, and that showed that there was low entertainment value on a lot of the books that they put out. It was high intellectualism and low on entertainment.
Okay, yeah.
And I think before you hit people with how strongly intellectual you can be, you've got to entertain them first.
Yeah, that's interesting, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. So you need to be popular. I mean, Pat's always saying this to us, isn't he? You need to be popular. You got to sell comics.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
A popular medium, you know.
Yeah, and to be honest, I mean, I found Black Crown was it was a cliquey and it was insidery. You know, I didn't feel cool enough to really be reading the comics.
I think, and I say this as a side note, but something that certainly put me off a couple of the creators is their absolute the fact they spent so much time on Twitter just shouting at people.
Yeah,
it certainly put me off at least one of the artists large. I just I blocked the nonsense that was coming out and. Is there to be said about, I mean, it's the nature of social media and the nature of creativity these days is we seem to know the people who make these books. I didn't have a clue what, you know, Roy Thomas or whoever looked like back in the day, but I don't know.
I'm sure Steve Ditko would not have been as popular today had his views been shared widely on social media at the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, there's a degree to which I think we need to separate the artists and the creators
it's a difficult thing to
from
do
their political views.
Yeah, we manage it sometimes, and it.
Well, the issue is when that artist and creator is absolutely determined to force their point of view in your face, regardless of what you think. And that's what turns me off. I mean, I can set aside a lot of stuff and sort of look at it objectively. But if it's too toxic to me, then I'm not going to pick up their work, you know, in the first place.
Exactly.
And there was a degree with, I mean, the creators, you know, certainly they're welcome to have their points of view, but they also need to understand today, as we understood back then, that if you do something really stupid, it's going to resound throughout all the different aspects of your life, you know?
It sadly is these days. That's a shame. Yeah.
And the
dog which I think is kind of where Shelley got it right. Shelley was forever a shouting through a megaphone about her book. You know, there was never any sort of arguments that I could see anyway that she got into. She was very great at communicating with us on the podcast and for example she came on, we chatted for about 45 minutes before we actually pressed record, and she stayed for about another half an hour talking about music with me afterwards, and it's so I admire that sort of thing, you know.
I love Shelley. I mean, she was clearly so passionate about what she was doing. And I think that was wonderful. And I know that that absolutely community creation and community curation was a huge part of what Black Crown was trying to do. You know, they did run their pub nights and everything else. I don't think I ever attended one, but they were trying to build community around the publication.
Yeah.
I think the problem was that it came across as too hip and too cool, with too much of a niche appeal for like a larger group than did read it to be involved or want to be involved.
It strikes me it's the sort of series as well that people will in 5-10 years time discover, and somebody will go, like I spent the weekend reading Kid Lobotomy and I just, this is what I thought about it, and the writing, I just, it's totally, and it's the sort of thing that could catch a fire by, you know, these sort of nostalgic seeking hipsters at some point, and people will maybe latch on again to. And I think Punk's Not Dead will be something like that as well.
Well, that'll be a movie or a TV series, I think, at some
point
for sure. And I'm sure that's a property that will get picked up. So I think you're exactly right. And part of the problem is, I think, is that in the cultivation and curation of these lines is that what's happening too quickly is things are not given enough time to build that audience. You know, it's like, and then that is, I think, a weakness of this sort of this era of needing instant success. Is if it doesn't sort of explode right out of the gate, then the tendency is to not allow a unique niche audience to build.
I wonder if
I was just saying, I don't think it was given long enough to run.
Yeah,
I don't
think
it's a format. Any of this was.
I was going that way with you. I was thinking if this came out, for example, if Kid Lobotomy was 6 pages every week in 2000 AD, I think people maybe would warm to it a bit better. You know, if House of Mock came out as a, you know, a nice album or a graphic novel or something like that, I
right.
think, I'll tell you what would work for that would be Euthanauts. I think that would make a great, because of the bigger format, the art's so gorgeous. Mm. I think if it came out as a big album presentation, I think that would do a lot better. And Eve Stranger, is a comic strip from Deadline or Escape magazine. There's no two ways about
right.
it, you know.
So I think, you know, something like Eve Stranger, which was more action-oriented, would have worked better as a series. But things like Euthanauts, like you say, that storyline needed room to breathe.
Yeah.
You know, it was clearly a slow burn into a much bigger story. And it just wasn't given enough. I think that would have worked had it been, like you said, like a deluxe trade paperback album or something, you know, that had come out in the style of, say, a European comic or a bande dessinée.
Yeah, exactly. And I'd buy a page of that work. I tell you, I would buy a page of his art. Gorgeous stuff. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, Assassinesis, that was just kind of a dud for me.
Least favorite. So let's do that. What was your favorite and your least favorite? So, favorite for you.
I gotta say, my favorite was Punk's Not Dead.
Okay, same for me.
Closely followed by, I think, Eve Stranger.
Okay.
I think that had some potential that was.
Yeah.
Could have been investigated.
Okay. Least favorite, Assassinistas.
Well, either that or, is Marilyn Manor even in? Is there something lower? Is there something lower than least favorite?
It's kind of. Yeah, it's just like it's like an asterisk at the bottom of the page, isn't it? Forget about Marilyn Manor.
The one we don't want to mention.
Yeah,
that'll be the one that ultimately we will
it's
want
like
to
my
forget.
Parents when they talk about me and my sister. Yeah, I'm sort of barely mentioned. But I get you. And the other one we haven't really spoken about is Hey Amateur. So Hey Amateur was Kickstarter that was done.
It's still going on, I believe. Is it?
Kickstarter's funded, and I believe it's just coming out now. I saw a picture that Shelley had put out of a box of the hardbacks.
So Hey Amateur was that was stuff that featured in Black Crown, like one or two pages or something in the quarterly.
Right.
And she decided to expand on that concept and make it into a Kickstarter, which has now got some of our favorite people in it. It's Lucy Sullivan, I think, is
Lucy in it. Oh, great. Lovely.
Lucy's in it. Yeah. She has a little tutorial on how to draw in contours. In there.
Well, I like that sort of thing. I was put off by one at once because I'm a grumpy old bastard, as you know. I was put off by one single advert, which was John Allison saying that he did a one page strip on how to do your pack, how to pack your shopping in the supermarket, and I thought, who the fuck is that for? Who buys a comic about packing your shopping?
Yeah. So once again, it's as you know, I think it's something that I don't believe happened with Black Crown was I don't think they really, really thought about their audience too deeply. I think a lot of it was just kind of, well, let's let the artists and creators and writers play and see what they come up with. And it'll find an audience, you know, that if you build it, they'll come sort of thing.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they built it and unfortunately nobody came. So anyhow, I think it's the same thing with Hey Amateur. I don't think we are necessarily the audience for how to ollie on a skateboard. I think there's the especially, you know, but there is a certain degree of sort of a market for life hacking and life hack skills. People just love that kind of stuff.
I don't know. It just came across as a little bit cheap to me.
Well, absolutely. But look at us. I mean, if we haven't gotten certain skills for how to live by now at our advanced ages, then we really need to go out.
I order it.
Who packs shopping anymore?
What's that all about?
I need to know how to use a rotary phone. Now, my understanding was that Shelley actually approached you for a piece on how to be a prozer.
Yes, there are a number of skills to be a prozer, a number of which I am quite well acquainted with. Yep.
So this could be sort of this is Hey Amateur, and then you've got the Hey Amateur sort of anarchists version
or
that
hey,
we could put out.
Hey
Working Girl.
Good. I think we certainly chewed the cud on that one. Get where I'm coming from on that one. Brilliant stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And I should really, I should at this point say that I really did overall like Black Crown.
Yeah. That was going to be my last question. So, for you, was it a success? Yeah.
For me, it was. And you know what? I would have kept reading it and I would have kept buying it.
Yeah.
And I really do wish that it had been given a little more time to settle in and develop maybe some of the other ideas in a more complex and nuanced fashion. You know, I think there was a lot of possibility here that will go unrealized, and I think we will regret. I regret losing it because I think there's a market for it.
Yeah.
I just don't think it was given long enough to uncover that market and
the old
engage.
Story about TV series don't get great until the third season, you know, stuff like that. And right. 2 years wasn't enough for this, was there at all?
Not for comics.
Yeah.
Not for comics. I mean, when you think about kind of, you know, how long we've had Marvel for and how long we've had DC and some of the other lines, you know, I mean, you know, Valiant has a very rich, deep universe.
Yeah.
But have I read anything from Valiant? I haven't.
That's
you know,
right.
I have read some Valiant stuff. But you know, it's that idea of that. It's difficult, especially with comics these days, to bring people on board and get them to commit to spending a large proportion of their monthly budget on increasingly expensive printed works.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, unfortunately, Black Crown, for me, it was incredibly original, and I would have stuck with it and been a fan of it and enjoyed it, I think. I really enjoyed what they were trying to do. I enjoyed the feel of it. I like the aesthetic of Black Crown.
Yeah.
And what they were trying to build. And overall, I found it was a little bit too inaccessible, but it was kind of like a cliquey cool club that you had to be on the list to get into.
Yeah.
But, you know, accessibility aside, I think I really enjoyed it. I think they brought on some outstanding talent, especially the artists.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say 50-50 for me. So I was incredibly enthusiastic at the launch, and it brought back such feelings of just those sort of standalone series I could invest in and were full of imagination and experimentation. Whether that played out, I'm going to say it probably didn't in the most part. I think people were picked for being hip rather than being amazing.
Yeah,
in the writing,
actually,
especially.
Yeah.
I think Punk's Not Dead, I was hugely excited about Punk's Not Dead. And after reading an issue, I would often message Dave or Martin and say, fucking hell, I didn't see that one coming. And I remember Martin saying to me, wait till you see the reveal next week. And there was a big reveal in the second series, which I'm very excited about. And I think some of it, you can. The books gave me incredible pleasure. And I, you know, for that half hour of reading Punk's Not Dead each time, it was really inspiring and interesting and something different, which I'm always looking for. But
I think you nailed it. You put your finger right on the problem. People were given, I think, especially the storytellers for a lot of these, they were handed the stories not because they were good, but because they were cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And it shows.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, that showed.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, there's at least three or four cases of that in the audience, especially in Black Crown Quarterly as well. Okay, mate. Thank you for that. That's good stuff. We've been going a while there. That's good.
Very enjoyable. Yeah. That's sorry, stuff, I didn't go too long.
Yeah. No. Not at all. Yeah. No. We like this. It's no rules.
Oh, no rules.
Yeah.
Cox.
Vince can't tell me off on this one. But he's coming on soon. I've talked to Vince coming on, so it should be quite exciting.
Good, awesome.
Him and Dan.
Fantastic.
We've got a couple of guests coming up in the next few weeks. But so did you want to talk about what you're up to? So we're finishing the comic that you and I are doing. That's the last thing to do.
And I have to apologize because this whole virus thing has
we're both
knocked
really busy.
The sticks.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's okay. So we've got all the pages done, apart from the cover, which is proving troublesome
come
to me.
It comes. It's fine.
It will. I've got some ideas. Don't worry. Yeah. I've got a plan.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
Yeah.
But I've realized, you know, I go to places like, they would be called, you know, office stores to get my copy scanning done.
Yeah.
I can't. They're all shut. I can't go get the bloody pages scanned.
Yeah.
You know, so I've been fishing around. If any of your readers happen to have a nice A3 scanner that they want to lend me for cheap
in Maryland.
In Maryland or Maryland, as we would say here, please, by all means, get in contact. So I'm doing that. So I'm really looking forward to getting that one out there because I think that one's.
Yeah,
I think Tony Osmond.
Like yeah, I really like that.
Tony Osmond. Not based on anyone we know.
No, clearly not. Yep.
Clearly not just a very small change in spellings of the last name. I think that is, I've really enjoyed drawing that one.
Yeah, cool.
I mean, it is, you know, we've been talking about, you've been talking about kind of the transgressive, but yet still entertaining kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I'm doing that. I think what else to, so might have a little something coming for somebody who's a friend of ours.
Yeah, very exciting. And I'm involved in it as well. In fact, I submitted my script for it today.
Awesome.
So very exciting. And the people making this particular comic came to me and said, what do you think about Cliff? I said, fucking get him on board straight away.
Yeah.
And you're on board now. So yeah, we're very excited about it, aren't we? Yeah.
Oh yes. Yeah. I couldn't be more happy, and I can't wait to talk about it. Cause I mean, there's things and stuff to unpack psychologically about my journey in comics and why this is exciting.
And just a quick plug for my stuff is, not for my stuff, but I'd just like to thank the Lakes today. The Lakes gave me and Adam the best review I've heard of our comic yet, where they just totally got it.
Atomic Hercules.
Yeah, Atomic Hercules. Sorry. Yeah, the Nikki and Ian. They just spotted everything I was talking about there. So there's layers to that comic, and they got them all, and I was very pleased about it. I sent them a message straight away. God love them. Yeah, good people.
There's a deeper message to Atomic Hercules. I might have missed that one.
There's you being sick into a toilet, which was probably the best
review. How could their review beat that? I mean, it made me puke. I actually.
That's going on the, that's going on the trade.
On
the toilet.
Yeah. On the trade, it made me puke.
It's like John Tucker's review. You know, the pull quotes on the back of John Tucker's new book. One's from Dan. It says, I haven't read it.
I didn't read it.
Now they've crossed it out and says, I have read it. And that's it.
I have read it. Genius. Yeah, well, so it was probably the best depiction of a man being killed by another man's cock I have ever read.
Something to be proud of, something for the grandkids.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how the physics of that works.
Well,
the kind
we'll
of
try it
force
out next time you're in England. Next time we're in a bar in Devon, we should try it out.
Man killed in Mevagissi by...
a posh Englishman was heard, come on Tony, let's give it a go.
Yeah, no, we're not doing that.
Okay, fair enough. Sarah wouldn't like it, she'd frown.
Sarah would be very judgmental about us trying.
Where can people
find what else have you got coming?
What else have we got coming out?
It was a very interesting interview you gave with the Awesome Comics people this last time with Mr. Falk. You were a guest on your own podcast.
I know, it was a bit meta, wasn't it?
Talk about disappearing up your own butthole.
I have to say, old Honest Review Month is I haven't had many submissions, to be honest.
Well, people are scared.
I think they are.
Chicken.
Yeah.
Chicken shit.
Yeah. Have you got a pair of bollocks on you, send me your comic, or if you're a lady and you haven't got bollocks, please send it anyway.
Just nut up. Jesus Christ, people.
Yeah.
I would never do it because my ego is way too fragile for that, but I would highly recommend everybody do it if they are, in fact, worthy. Or maybe you're just a chicken shit little coward. You can't take it. You can't take a little bit of Tony criticizing you.
Thank you.
I think honestly, it's been my favorite month because you're fair about it.
I've got ones lined up for tomorrow, which I've got to write in the morning. But they're coming out daily. And if you go over there now, you can see the one for Marilyn Manson. Sorry, Marilyn Manor. What an amazing.
You've already
forgotten the name of it.
Marilyn, I don't care.
What an amazing comic.
Amazing.
I'm that. Where can we find you online, Mr. C?
Oh yes, yeah. Well, mostly I'm on the Twitters at CG Cumber, very imaginative Twitter handle of mine, and it's the same thing on Instagram. And I occasionally do my own little comics pod. Can I say that?
Yeah, of course you can, babe. Yeah, of course.
All right, my own little comics podcast that you can find on just on Podbean. Because it's very niche,
curated. I don't know how to work an image to put it onto iTunes.
Exactly. Well, I like to think of it as a more artisanally curated podcast in which it only features on a very specific channel, right, because it's the coolest channel that we could find is Podbean. But yes, so I do have my own little rambling comics podcast, Comics Unencumbered.
Very good. I do enjoy that when it comes out. Always the first thing I listen to, as soon as it comes out, I listen to it straight away. Yeah, very good stuff.
That's easy to say.
Thank you, man. You can follow me on Twitter, S-O-S-E-Z-O-H-Y-Z. You can buy my comics if you can be bothered at neverironanything.bigcartel.com. And you can find Honest Review Month, which is still going on for another 2 weeks, neverironanything.blogspot.com.
Very professional.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm reading from my script again. Thank you for coming on, Cliff Cumber.
It was my pleasure to come on your show, Tony Esmond. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And as they say, the rest is history.